good morning. It's meant to be Monday, but for me it feels like Friday, so I don't know. I also want to apologize. I have a bit of a cold, so if I'm sounding weird, or if I have to sneeze through halfway. So we've been talking about these great microscopes and all these wonderful programs that we have, but without samples, good samples, and a way to prepare samples, we really can't take advantage of any of these things. So what Andrew and I are going to talk about is, you know, ways that you can prepare samples. And, you know, this is just going to be examples. There's many other ways, but I'm going to show you some ways that we prepare samples. And one of the things I do is take advantage of all the properties that lipids have and utilize lipid scaffolds for structure determination. So I'm going to tell you about two techniques that are used in this, using lipids. The first one is, so I know a lot of these old-timers in the audience have seen this slide a million times, but a lot of other ones have been in high school when it was made, because this was like made 20 years ago. This technique, the 2D lipid layer crystallization technique, was pioneered really by Roger Kornberg and Ed Deuskerius about 20 years ago. And what it does, you take advantage of the polar head groups and you spread a lipid over the air-water interface, and in the subphase you have your protein particles, protein molecules, and they're attracted to the polar head groups, either specifically or non-specifically, so the head groups can be derivatized, or you can take advantage of charged polar head groups, and your protein is concentrated then at the air-water interface and protected from the air by the acyl groups of the lipid, and the protein molecules concentrate themselves and orient themselves laterally, because the lipid is somewhat fluid, and form, hopefully in the best cases, 2D arrays. And then one simply can come down with an EM grid. This is just a cartoon showing you, like, an example. This would be an EM grid. And you can transfer the 2D crystals onto an EM grid, and then you can either freeze them or negatively stain. And so I've got here a little sample I can show you. You can pass this around. You can also do this in very small little Teflon blocks. And in this Teflon block, there's little wells that hold up to about 10 microliters of protein. And your protein concentrations are usually anywhere between 50 micrograms, like 200 micrograms per ml. So these are like very small amounts of protein. And then you just come down with 1 microliter of lipid that's in a chloroform solution. It spreads on top, and chloroform evaporates very quickly. And then you can put this little, this is just a little petri dish where you have some buffer around it so it's kept humid, and you can keep this at room temperature or put it in the cold and wait various amounts of time. So you can have a look at that. So again, just to remind, the next slide just, oops. So some of the advantages of this technique, you can use the small amounts of protein. So unlike crystallography, you don't need milligram quantities of your precious protein. And you can, the buffers that you can use can be physiological, pH 7 or whatever. And then it provides a more native-like environment to study proteins that naturally bind to the lipid membranes. And then I'm going to talk a little bit more about the, you know, how it can be absorbed specifically or non-specifically to the lipid surface. But just before I do that, this is just a very short list. There's many, many more proteins that have been crystallized using this grade, and I don't want to offend anybody in the audience that probably have crystals that I haven't put on this list, because this was made up in the 90s, and even some of the crystals I've done are not on here. So, but this is just showing that there, by non-specific binding, using positively or negatively charged lipid layers, these are some of the proteins that have been crystallized, and then using specific binding, these are some of the other proteins. So I'm not going to go into, this is not a biological talk, just to talk on methods. So let's talk about, this is my favorite, the closest to my heart. And it's also favorite because nickel lipids provide a common moiety where you can bind lots of large variety of histac proteins that are being purified in many different labs. So I'm going to come back to this one a bit later and give you a bit more information about how this works. Another one that's been used is the bicinylated lipids that bind streptavidin, and then you can use streptavidin as an adapter molecule, and then maybe as a thymocrystal bind proteins to streptavidin. And then there's the natural lipid ligands that have been used, like the cholera toxin binds to GM ganglioside GM1, and tetanus toxin binds to GT1. And of course, this is the synthetic lipid that was made from Roger Kornberg and Ernst Jasgeris that showed for the first time that you can take a synthetic lipid and form 2D crystals by using a dinitrophenol phosphatidylethanolamine lipid and bind these anti-DNP antibodies. So that was the pioneer work for them. They really opened up this field. And then, of course, there's the non-specific interactions. There's many different lipids, and if you want to find out more about them, you can ask me later at lunchtime. So DOPC is a positively charged, and DOTAP is also positively charged in this serine at the end there, that serine head group on this DOPS lipid that is negatively charged. So you don't have to grow 2D crystals on lipid layers. You can also study, right now, I'm studying this propingylysin protein, and propingylysin naturally binds to cholesterol on lipid layers, and so in the cell. And propingylysin is actually a monomeric protein, but when it binds to cholesterol, it forms these rings, and so we're studying these rings. And these rings are made up of anywhere between 30 and 40 monomers of the propingylysin. It's a toxin secreted by Clostridium propingens. And what we've been able to do is label, like, put cysteines in strategic places and label them with biotin and then bind streptavidin. So what we're seeing is streptavidin binding to the outside of these rings, showing that this particular amino acid is facing the outside part of the ring. And then there's another amino acid here that's been, that we know that should be in the inside of the ring, and we can label it with streptavidin and see that the amino acid is inside the ring. So it's a way, it's sort of a way to understand structure and function by using the lipid layers. So I just wanted to point out that this is like a natural phenomenon that these proteins do bind to the cholesterol. Their cytolysin is a member of the cytolysin family, and all these proteins bind to cholesterol. So there's different ways that you can use the lipid layer. And this is just transferred onto a carbon support film. Now, going back to the 2D crystals, you can transfer them onto the Holy film. This was done in 1991, where a lot of you were still in high school or elementary school. So at that time, we didn't have the quantifier grids. But anyway, if you just zoom in, so this was something that I found out, that you could transfer the 2D crystals onto the holes and actually preserve the crystallinity of the 2D crystals quite well. And if you look at inside one of these holes, you'll see, well, maybe you can't see because the lights are up, but this is a 2D crystal of streptavidin. Is that dark enough? So now you'll believe that there is 2D crystals in these holes, and this is a negatively stained sample of streptavidin. If you were to preserve this in glucose or vitreous ice, so it's in your handout that says vitreous ice, but actually this is what I did in 1991, is preserved streptavidin over holes in glucose. And so the resolution, the low resolution, is not very well preserved, but these diffraction peaks here go out to better than 3 angstroms, or about 2.8 angstrom peaks out here. So it shows that you can span these crystals over holes and preserve them to high resolution. And then Augustin Avila-Sakhar in Wachu's lab then extended this and worked further on this and actually froze the streptavidin crystals over holes in vitreous ice and got much nicer diffraction patterns and showed that this area here was beta sheet, and you could see that very nicely in his reconstruction from using images and diffraction patterns that this was beta sheet, which we know from streptavidin. But it's a way to show that, you know, this method actually works. I asked Diane Taylor, is anybody here from Ken Taylor's lab? Okay, so I think you'll know Diane Taylor. I asked her to send me some slides because she has become an expert in transferring things onto holy carbon film. And the Taylor group has studied many, many actin-binding proteins, and I'm just showing you now actin-RAS that she's bound to positively charged lipid layers. And this is an example of one of So there are many people in the group working on that, and but she's the expert at doing the crystallization part. And this is just alkylase is an actin cross-linking protein. It's just to show you that, you know, you can get these rafts, they diffract, and this is just a larger, it's just a blow-up of this computer analyzed picture. And so that with the streptavidin was a specific binding, and this is binding via a charge interaction, and there's many other groups now using the way, you know, following her way of transferring to Holy Grids, and I think Dorothy's group has repeated this, and so you can other groups can repeat it and still get really nice results. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the advantages of using metal chelating lipids, such as like the nickel lipid. This provides a common moiety, as I was saying, to binding a large variety of the histide proteins, so that's one advantage. You don't just have a specific head group or one protein. And then you can have a unique orientation of your protein or complex. And you can put your histidine tag anywhere you want. So if you want it at the N-terminus or the C-terminus or in the middle of the protein, so you can have different orientations of your protein. That might help you also to avoid this missing cone problem in 2D crystallography. And also people have utilized it by cutting off the transmembrane part of your protein and replacing it by a his tag and then trying to look at the cytosolic part of your membrane protein, which is usually the most interesting because that's the one that binds the ligands and things. And this can be done in, I like the lipid layer in physiological conditions, but the advantage is you can really, if you have a specific binding via metal, it doesn't matter how high your salt conditions are. You can go up to whatever you want. And it is just in case you're not familiar with this technique, this is one of the nickel lipids that I had Avanti make, and this is the NTA head group, and it chelates the nickel. So this is the little green dots here are the nickel on the chelated to the head group, and this is your protein. So it's the same. You can form these in 2D. And this is just an example from the first example where I showed that this actually works. You can't really see this very well, but this reverse transcriptase bound to the nickel lipid, and you can't see the crystal. You can at least see it diffract. So that was the first example, but there's been many, many more. And I think you remember from Mark Yeager's talk that he showed that the capsid protein from a murine leukemia virus was crystallized on the same nickel lipid. And also, shortly after I did this, Arvaisilia and I showed that you could crystallize, this is MHC class 1, onto the same nickel lipid that I just showed you. And this diffracts, this ring here diffracts to showing diffraction up to 3.5 angstroms. And he's continued this work with Alok Mitra and Luke Payton, and they have now really nice pictures, and there's going to be a publication on this soon, so you can look out for it. I think it'll be a very nice work. So another thing that, so when I came to Ron's lab, you know, I'd done enough 2D crystallization, and I wanted to take advantage of this helical approach. So I searched the literature and found this list of this galactosyl ceramide from Rick Brown's group, and now I've actually had Avanti make it, so these things are all commercially available now. And if I mix these, this one is known to form a tubular lipid array, form tubular lipid arrays. And if you mix it with, or dope it with a nickel lipid, then you can form, well, I'm actually just going to tell you how you do this. It's pretty much, you just mix the cerebicide with any of your lipid of choice, either your synthetic or your natural lipids. You dry it down under argon. And be suspended in the desired buffer for your protein. Neither sonicating or vortex is enough to form these tubes, lipid tubes. So this is an example of how the lipid tubes look like in negative stain. They can be actually very long, like several microns in length. Their diameter is about 27 nanometers. You'll see some other structures in the background coming from the cerebral side, and sometimes you'll see little vesicles, but the majority If the process is going well and the mixture that you've made is good, the majority of your grid will be covered in these lipid tubules. And this is just, I'm just going to show you some examples now of the lipid tubules in negative stain where I've added some proteins. This is RNA polymerase. This is little molecules of RNA polymerase in the background. You can actually see features of them if you're close enough up here. And you can see that they form quite well-ordered arrays. There is some areas where it doesn't bind. There's some areas where it's disordered. And there's, again, areas here that's ordered. So I'm not saying that every single tube in your prep is going to have these beautiful crystals on it. There is still some problems, and I'm still developing this technique. I'm just trying to show you that it's quite a nice technique, so hopefully other people pick it up and help me develop it. This is another example of, this is the, Ca63 is the component of anthracotoxin that forms the pores. And these form pores in the lipid and allow the lethal and edema factors to eventually penetrate into the cytosol. So these little Ca63 makes a heptameric pore, and these form on positively charged tubules. And this is work I did with Alok Mitra, Nivisat script. So that's just another example of negative stain. And this is an example of the provincialization now. So I showed that it forms these rings. Also, you can have monomeric PFO, and that actually crystallizes quite nicely on the nickel lipid tubes. So actually, to combine how the monomeric forms are beginning maybe to bind to lipid and interact, and then study the rings to have a full idea of how these monomeric soluble proteins can bind to lipid and eventually insert. So I'm using different approaches to study this protein. This is an example. If you can't really, the PFO is too small, you can't really see very well that it is a crystal, but you can see under the laser that it diffracts, so we know that it is. This is the large Ca63, the heptamer. And you can also, of course, do this in ice, which, you know, is what you're here to learn. So if you look at these tubes, this is just a blow-up to show that these tubes are, in fact, are unilamellar and have a bilayer, which one could maybe take advantage of. And this is just an example of the provincialization in ice, and the peaks are sharper in ice. And I have actually done three-dimensional reconstructions, but for the purpose, not showing it for the purpose of this talk, but obviously you can take these diffraction patterns and make three-dimensional models. Three-dimensional reconstruction, sorry. And this is streptavidin again, showing again that you can do this in ice. And so the advantages of having lipid tubules over the two-dimensional lipid layers is that I don't need to really go into this again because you've heard it so many times that you have all the required molecular views and you don't have, there's no tilting required. And also the preparation of these lipid tubules are really rapid. You know, that little flow chart that I showed you, basically you could make tubes in 5 minutes. So that is simple. And also the advantage of having the membrane and for studying membrane-associated proteins. And these samples, since you can make them and you can keep them in little Eppendorf tubes, you can put them wherever you want at any temperature, and you can actually put them in the warm and put them in the cold and take them out of the cold. So you can really manipulate these tubes easier than you can with the 2D lipid layers. And then all you need to do is take a drop out of your Eppendorf tube, drop it directly onto your grid, lock and freeze or preserve it negative stain. And again, of course, you've got all the options of either Holy grids or carbon grids, so they're easily manipulated. And these are just different helical arrays that I have formed on these nickel tubes. They're on different tubes. These are formed on the nickel. These are antibodies, the provincialization, the bison lipid tubes, streptavidin. Positively charged tubes have shown the E. coli RNA polymerase. The geactin also crystallizes Ca63 and Nexin. But of course, there's other people working, and hopefully you've got many more. This is just examples of what you can do. So. Any questions? One thing I did leave out is that on the 2D lipid layer, that list was very short, and there has actually been success with fluorinated lipids where people have tried to use the two-dimensional lipid layers to crystallize membrane proteins. And I've been in France, have been particularly successful. Daniel Levy's group and Gervais Moser and Luc Lebeau have crystallized membrane proteins using the two-dimensional lipid layer. But I think Andrew's going to explain another method of using lipids for crystallization. So, are there any questions? At first approximation, they look pretty similar, but when you actually start to do reconstructions, there's very slight variations that is enough to change indexing patterns. So that's one of the problems. So I've been working on trying to stabilize the tubes, working with chemists and different people to see if there's a way to stabilize them. But one can't, so these are unsaturated lipids, so they are pretty fluid. But if you put in saturated lipids, then the protein no longer crystallizes. So there's a sort of a little bit of a trade-off. You know, your crystallinity might be, your indexing might be vary along the tube, so you might just have different families even on the one tube. But with these new methods that Nigel was talking about where you just take small areas, we're hoping that we can just split everything up in different families and eventually average the different families. So it may not be a problem using these new computational methods, but it is a problem in general. If somebody could figure out a way to make nice constant diameter of the tubes, that would be really helpful. So depending on which lipids that you use, it's very easy if you've got the right combination. There's, you know, with the nickel lipids that aren't commercially available and people are making themselves, basically it takes 5 minutes. So it's very simple. You just mix your lipids in a chloroform solution, dry it down, add your buffer vortex, and you have your tube. So. In 5 minutes, I could tell you that it's got any chance of working, yeah. Because you can make the tube, add the protein, and it either binds or it doesn't bind. And if it binds, then you can vary the ratio of lipids that you're mixing, incubation times, the concentrations of the protein. So you have the same parameters that you play around with any crystallization trials. But for initial screening to see if it's going to work at all, it really should be very quick. I think you can tell rather quickly, you know, if it's not going to, if it doesn't bind, then obviously it's not worth, you know, working any longer than the day. And then if it binds, then I would spend probably a week or two trying to get it to organize by using different things. If it doesn't do it in that time, then it's probably not going to work. That's been my experience. Yes? I wouldn't say it prefers. I mean, most of these things that have crystallized on the helical arrays will also crystallize in two dimensions. I'm just using the helical arrays because I don't want to go through the long process of, you know, tilting and everything. So if I can get the advantages of having helical reconstruction, I'd rather go that way. But there is some cases where one will prefer one of the other. But in general, I'd say if it crystallizes on nickel lipid, it'll do it both ways. Just one other thing. I have a lot of these papers, this manuscript with shown about the lipid tubules. If anybody wants one, they're welcome.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you about some of my experiences with membrane proteins, particularly sugar transporters and ABC transporters. Now, this is by no means an overview of the field, and I don't think anyone has a really good idea how to make membrane proteins into crystals. So I'll tell you the path I took and where I'm at right now, which is pretty successful in developing some screening assays that within a week's time, I'll have an idea whether or not I can reconstitute a membrane protein and somehow refine that, drive it into a crystal, helical or two-dimensional. So general idea about reconstitution is that you have an amphipathic membrane protein where there's hydrophobic regions in the middle, which need to be satisfied by small detergent molecules and charged solvent-exposed bases of the membrane protein. So somehow we have to take that soluble membrane protein, solubilize in detergent, mix it with some lipids and maybe some other detergents, remove the detergents, and actually force the membrane protein to interact with lipids, get back into lipids, and form maybe a two-dimensional crystal or a helical crystal. So when I first arrived at Ron's lab with, you know, a few microliters of protein, I decided I would try Liz's Gaussaire scaffolding. So I tried to take advantage of the fact that, as Liz was saying, you can preform these tubes, which are extremely easy to make, and doped with nickel. The membrane proteins that I was working with were conveniently purified by a polyhistidine tag. So my idea was that I could take these membrane proteins, mix them with the preformed tubes, add some extra lipids, and then pull out some detergent and force these membrane proteins to form on the scaffold via the nickel-histidine interactions, and then fill in the gaps with another membrane, so have a membrane on top of a membrane. Unfortunately, this didn't work so well, and here I show a nice tube, time zero. After an hour of mixing with proteins and lipids, maybe you can see some interaction, maybe not. There's a lot of background. And then after one day, if I don't dialyze out detergent, the tubes get chewed up and I have crashed out protein, and that's not good. An experiment I did later on, actually, with dialysis, preserved the Gaussaire scaffold tubes and actually grew different helical tubes. But I'll actually get to how I grew these later, too. So there's a variety of detergent removal strategies. Just going to explain a couple. Dialysis membranes, which are, you set up small volumes in these buttons, dialysis buttons, 20 microliters or less. And the only problem with these is they're extremely hard to set up, and oftentimes you lose a lot of your precious sample. They're messy. And they're slow. Dialysis takes overnight sometimes, and that's not really useful for screening, especially in the beginning. So there's also dilution where, I'm sorry, I should actually explain about critical micelle concentration with detergents, and that's basically at the point if you have X molar concentration of detergent, if you're above the critical micelle concentration, you're going to preserve micelles and keep the protein satisfied, happy. And then when you go below that, you're going to start forcing the protein to either interact with itself or with lipids and hopefully form a crystal. So these strategies are basically, you start above the critical micelle, and with one of these strategies, bring it below the critical micelle and force interaction. So in my screening, dialysis membrane slow, not useful. Dilution is very fast, but it's almost instantaneous where you're going to bring your protein from above the critical micelle to below, and oftentimes you get a lot of crashing out, and concentrations, protein to lipid ratios can change unfavorably. So I came upon BioBeads, which are very fast, very easy, and it's actually extremely easy to vary the rate. So these are small plastic beads that adsorb detergent, and it can be easily added to crystallization trials. So this is my general attempt at preparing BioBeads, taken from Journal of Structural Biology paper by Rigaud, 1997. And you take these small white BioBeads, clean them with methanol, and wash the BioBeads in buffer. And at this point, you can either wash with detergent or without detergent. And some people have the view that when you prime with detergent, it actually slows down the reaction and gives you more control. I actually do not use detergent here, so I guess it's personal preference. And then I store these BioBeads wet on moist filter paper for up to 1 month. Here's a nice picture of what happens when I use the BioBeads. And here you can see a diffuse background of various protein, lipid, detergent species at 2 hours in a small crystal nucleating right here. After 6 hours, you can see the species are getting bigger, and you're forming some reconstituted proteolysosomes, and the crystal's actually getting longer. And after about 16 hours, so overnight, I'll come back in, and all the background will be cleaned up, and the protein and lipid will be sequestered in either a nice helical array or a vesicle or some other species. So after the gas air experiments didn't work so well, I went back and designed these screens, and I just wanted to give you guys a quick idea about what I do. And I set up a basic matrix, which is usually, you know, just like a 6x8 matrix in a small plate and small volumes, 20 to 40 microliters. So I'm using the minimum amount of protein I can. And all I do is I vary the pH, usually between 4 and 9. A lot of the membrane proteins that I work with are purified at really low pH, which force protonates a lot of the hydrophobic patches in the membrane regions. So generally, the lower pHs are the more successful ones. I vary the protein to lipid ratio anywhere between 1 to 1 to 10 to 1 in both directions. And I'll show you maybe the results of that. And also, lipid choice is important. In my case, I use a charged lipid, but there's also, I mean, if you look in the Avanti catalog, there's quite a variety of lipids. I generally start with an E. coli whole membrane extract, and then I pick out a whole extract and then maybe one, two, or three more specific cleaner choices. And in general, the cleaner the lipid, meaning the more, or the if you have one lipid, it usually forms better crystals than if you have a mix of membranes. And then after I set up my basic matrix and I decide whether or not I can get the protein to interact with lipids and go back into bilayers, then I'll refine with a variety of things, additives. I refine with alcohols, hexanes, just small organics. And I think this might actually help packing or satisfy some of the hydrogen bonding, that's more black magic than I know anything about. So then I can vary the different concentrations of all my crystallization additives. This is where I go back and I try maybe dialysis or dilution at varying temperature, and this goes on, you know, infinitely. But one thing to keep in mind and that's been successful for me is that I work with an ABC transporter, so it binds nucleotide and it also binds substrate. And adding addition of both of these things have really helped to drive a more well-ordered crystal. So presumably it's helping the protein form some rigid conformation. So a couple quick pictures. This is, you know, maybe a typical result from a screen I'll get. Here you can see these small circles are proteolysosomes, so the protein's actually going into lipids but forming these small species, and I have way too much lipid, so I'm forming these, you know, giant empty vesicles. So that's just a typical result I'll get. And then here, this is a good result. You'll start to see, you know, tracks and pseudo-crystalline interactions forming, kind of like what Nigel showed last night. And then you're really lucky, you form nice, in this case, helical crystals. Here, the crystal, the protein reconstitutes and then seemingly spins out of the lipid membrane. These are just three species of the same protein that I work with. And here, there's some really nice pictures where these are small vesicles, and they basically are cross-sections of these helices. So just a couple words about the different helical arrays and where I am. Gaussian tubes, I think, perhaps, with problems, at least with membrane proteins, because of the confined geometry, so they're forced, you know, to array themselves around the 270 angstrom diameter. They're susceptible to dissurgeon, like I was saying. And when, as Liz alluded to, there can be a template for any star helix, which is a problem for processing, and it's very burdensome. So I have these, which I'm calling native tubes, and here the protein drives the helix. So in my case, I get about 75% of the same family, 75% of one family, and makes the processing a lot easier to do. Now, it might be slower, but it works, so it's good enough for me. So I just want to show you some results I've had in both helical and two-dimensional. And here's just a picture over an ice hole, very long, two up to 3 micron helical crystals, very straight. Here's a high mag image, diffraction. And originally I had these diffract to about 20 angstroms, and varying things with some of the refinements I mentioned, they're down to about 10 angstrom now. So two-dimensional arrays are also useful. I mean, they're less useful for me because I don't get a three-dimensional picture in a short amount of time. But they can either form arrays where they're up, down, or they're all in the same orientation. And then, of course, they can form stacks, which I've had problems with, and these aren't so useful for processing. Here's an example of the same protein you saw that was helically arrayed, and these large 1 by 2 micron crystals over an ice hole again. Nice diffraction up to about 20 angstrom, and high mag, and then filtered image, as Vincenz was showing you can do. And here you can see rows of up and rows of down. So that's one orientation. And then here in 2D crystal, this is a sugar transporter, high mag image, filtered image, and here they're all in the same orientation, but they're basically oriented 90 degrees apart from each other. And these, again, go to probably about 15 angstrom. So just some words about what makes a good crystal. We want low mosaicity and no variation in helical pitch. So basically, we want the same crystal throughout our crystal. We don't want it to vary. The larger the 2D, usually the stronger the diffraction, and longer, straighter helical tubes make for better processing, I guess. Low backgrounds, so that there's no noise contribution to your diffraction. And especially with helical, a system amenable to cryo. So what I mean by that is something that actually stays helical or stays crystalline when you freeze it, because I started out trying to reconstruct negative stain helical diffraction patterns and had quite a difficult time doing so. And that's it.
How big are those?
Usually just 6x8, so 40. I have small 48 well plates. Well, depending on how much protein I got, I would probably widen my screen. But in general, I'll usually always get a hit that will reconstitute. And then from there, I can make a finer screen that will actually tell me whether or not I can drive some formation of ordered arrays. I mean, it takes maybe an hour to plate it and a day to check all, I mean, then overnight incubation and then a day to check all the grids, unless you guys help us out. The faster removing detergents. Right. So you can. I mean, I just mean to say that they're easy to work with. So if I dialyze in the cold, then it slows it down. And you know, depending on how many biobeads I add, I can also control the reaction coordinate. So you don't necessarily always want to be fast. But if an overnight experiment, if in, you know, 12 hours I can remove all the detergent, I can get a pretty good idea of whether or not that protein will go back into a lipid bilayer. And, you know, 99% of the time, there's crashed out protein in nice big vesicles, which is not useful for structural analysis.
So
I usually just add, if I have a 20 or 30 microliter volume, I'll add 3 biobeads. And then after an hour of incubation, add 3 biobeads, leave it overnight. And then for a refinement, I may add 1 at a time every 10 minutes to try to slow that down, perhaps. They look like really small white sand particles. Yeah, I mean, just with forceps, one by one, pick them up. I mean, people have showed experiments where they weigh out a certain amount of biobeads per, but they're all different sizes, and it's almost impossible to weigh out a milligram of biobeads. So, I do get that, and I showed you some of the railroad track images, but generally they're not diffracting, and I'm sure you could do some type of approach, but I'd rather utilize diffraction, I guess, for reconstruction. So certainly you see that. So you do. So here, these vesicles are actually ordered. And then when they get ordered to a certain arrangement, presumably the geometry of that packing drives a crystalline lattice. So this is one nucleotide state, and then the same protein in a different nucleotide state forms two-dimensional crystals. So presumably it's conformationally driven. They're fairly well ordered, though I wouldn't know how to process them. I mean, I filtered images of them, but basically they look like just a single cross section of one of those helical arrays. You think it's worth doing something? Oh. It would be useful, but they're not, I don't think they're homogeneous enough to do averaging. Or it would involve a considerable effort to actually pick the ones which were rotationally symmetric. I normally start with 0.3 mg per mil protein. And that's varied anywhere between 0.1 and 1 mg per mil. I actually haven't done an intense reconstruction with any of the 2D yet. I'm actually still suspicious that they might be stacking, so I haven't tried that, but presumably I will, or my first step will be to collect over the flattest carbon substrate that I can. Okay, so I actually get these proteins for free, which is nice. So, but all I have to do is look at the protein in an electron microscope and kind of evaluate whether it's a good prep or a bad prep. And I guess I've looked at hundreds of preps now. So I have sort of a trained eye, but generally the crystal, you're going to get pretty good crystals if you have a nice monodisperse, amorphous, looking prep where you can't see any structural species. And if I do see that, I'll often add maybe some detergent or lipids to try to separate everything out as much as possible. And I've tried some bad preps, and I've looked at bad preps, and which meaning they're either reconstituted already into some vesicular conformation, or they're crashed out, and those generally don't give good reconstitution. Thank you.